Hello, my friend. You're tuned in, and I mean that literally, to Beyond the Matrix, the program that invites you to get out of the sticky goo of the matrix of confined thought and soar with the eagles in the promised land, as they say. And it's a big responsibility when you take yourself out of that box. I know. It is much easier down there fiddling around things like your cell phone and what's for dinner and Big Macs. But when you get out, can't get back in again, but when you get out, you talk to people like my guest tonight. Whoa. The name is Thomas J. Carey. He's one of the, he's co-author with Donald Schmidt of a really important book called Witness to Roswell. We're going to be talking about Roswell. You know that's one of my favorite subjects. But before I get to that, I'd just like to remind you, if you're on my mailing list, you already know. If you aren't, I've put out an appeal. The International Whaling Commission is holding their whatever in Portugal in these days, and Denmark, supposedly cultured, civilized country, has asked Greenland to take on the murder and slaughter of 50 more humpback whales. Figured out why they do this. It's not only sport. A whale is worth about $500,000 in commercial product. So my friend Hardy Jones, who is the director of BlueVoice.org, has put out an appeal, and I'm helping him. Please, you've got to write to this dude, the Prime Minister of Denmark, and you've got to ask him to stop this ridiculous murder. So I don't have the access. My computer's not on now because of sound reverb, so please write to me at info@SyrianRevelations.net, and I'll give you the email of this man. I am appealing to you, if you care about this planet, take 2 seconds to send an email to this man so that other countries won't follow suit and we get back into the massive slaughter of the already decimated population of whales on our planet. Okay, that's me breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing in. Thomas J. Carey. Book. I mean, I thought I had read a lot about Roswell, but boy, I guess I hadn't. His website is roswellinvestigator.com. As I said, he's a co-author, so I only have him on tonight. But we'll get Donald R. Schmidt, his partner, in another moment. The book is Witness to Roswell. Gather up your friends. This is a night you're not going to want to miss. I'm sorry, I always forget. It's daytime on the other side of the Atlantic. Okay, Witness to Roswell, unmasking the government's biggest cover-up. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Patricia. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm just really excited. Don't mean to be paranoid. Ah, yes. Welcome again to the show.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Thank you. I don't know where to begin here. I mean, all right. Let's do this. First of all, there is so much information here, and this is one of the rare books I've managed to read all the way through, because doing a show once a week, that's not always easy.
Absolutely.
But it really is a page-turner. The only problem I have with this book is I can't keep track of all of the witnesses and all of the incredible information you've got. So you're going to have to give us basically an introduction, an overview to, you know, what got you started with the Roswell story, and we'll take it from there.
Okay. I was always interested in UFOs, as a lot of us are,
yeah,
when I was a kid, and read a lot of the Kehoe books, Donald E. Kehoe and Frank Edwards and so forth. But when the 1980 Roswell Incident book came out, that was the first one on the Roswell Incident by William Moore and Charles Berlitz, I was hooked on this notion of crashed saucers. Up until that point, crashed saucers were sort of verboten. They were just not talked about in the UFO community, because they had the idea was that in the 1950s they had this group called Contactees who claimed that they had gone to Mars and to Venus and Jupiter and you know, it's sort of wild stories like that, and they associated with crash saucers with that group. But as the years went by, a fellow in Cincinnati, Ohio, by the name of Len Stringfield, was a UFO investigator, and he accumulated a lot of stories about these from people who claimed to have participated either in recovering crash saucers or having seen them or being secondhand witnesses to information about them and so forth. Well, the Roswell incident occurred in 1947. And by 1978, some of those fellas who were involved in that were starting to see the end of the tunnel and started talking. Are you still there?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I'm just not interrupting you.
It was silent. I wasn't sure. So anyway, they started talking, and one of them talked to Stanton Friedman, who was one of the original investigators of the case. And
Stanton's a good friend of my show. He's been on a few times.
Yes, and that was 1978. 2 years later, the first book, The Roswell Incident, came out, and I was hooked on that particular story. And so few years went by. I'm still in school, and I finally get out of school, and I was a subscriber to the International UFO Reporter, which is a publication still by the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. So I read about these two fellows, Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, were reopening the Roswell investigation. Now, this is around 1990, and so it's 10 years after the first book came out, and they're going to reopen the investigation, and they talked about these fellows who, part of the Roswell legend was that the group of archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania were the ones who actually discovered the downed craft. And I said, well, geez, I'm living right outside of Philadelphia, where the University of Pennsylvania is located. And, hold on here. Okay. The other phone went off. Hasn't rung all day, and there it goes. And I also have a background in archaeology. So I called up Randall, and I said, what have you done on, you know, about these archaeologists who allegedly found the ship? And he said, well, we did some preliminary investigation, but we can't take it any farther, blah, 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 blah. So I said, let me have a crack at it. And he said, go to it. And so I went down to the university in Philadelphia and started looking around to see if I could find out about these archaeologists. And that's how I got started on this case as an active investigator. And that was 1991, 18 years ago. And I can't believe it. It's now 18 years later, and I'm still on the case, certainly beyond the archaeologists. But that's how I got started.
So, by what I've read. Okay, let's just give, I would think that my audience probably is well up to date on what the Roswell incident is. I think most people have got their head out of the box, know the story, but I would like to just briefly outline the the most poignant or important details, i.e., what exactly was assumed to have happened, the farmer finding the craft, and just the most salient details we can get people up to a certain level of awareness before we go further into the interview.
Okay, the salient details are that on July the 8th, 1947, the Air Force issued a press release saying that they had recovered a crashed flying saucer near the town of Roswell, New Mexico. They had been alerted to it by the rancher, Mac Brazel, who found it on his ranch about 75 miles northwest of Roswell. A day later, the Air Force came out with another press release saying that it wasn't a crashed flying saucer, but a down, the weather balloon. Now, this would be a rubber and tin foil affair, your standard weathered balloon. The story was a one-day story around the world, and it had its legs cut out from under it by the second press release that it was a weather balloon. So 30 years went by before the first person involved in that talked. That would be Jesse Marcel, the base intelligence officer. He told Stanton Friedman that he had held pieces of a weather, pieces of a flying saucer. Pieces of a flying saucer, Freudian slip there.
I had Jesse Marcel Jr. on the show just a few weeks ago, and he recounted how his father brought home these bits and woke him out of bed. He said, here I was in a sound sleep, and my father said, got us up and put all this stuff out on the floor. Can you imagine it? And he recounted having seen the strange hieroglyphics on the metal and as well.
Yes. Yes.
Boy, can you imagine?
Major Marcel, according to his son Jesse Jr., when he brought that home, he was back on his way back to the base in Roswell, but he stopped home first because he felt what he found was so exotic. He was convinced, according to his son, even at that point, that it was a spaceship from another planet. And that's why he stopped home, to show it to his family, because it was so unique, and he felt it was, at that point, it was a flying saucer. So Jesse Marcel, by going public with Stanton Friedman in 1978, kick-started the civilian investigation of the Roswell incident, and we're now many years beyond that, and the civilians, myself and Don Schmidt included, are still investigating the Roswell incident, and that's where we are, and that's basically the salient points of it, without going into this witness and that witness.
Yeah, no, that would be difficult, but we do want to also just overview for the people that are listening, that basically the story goes that the farmer heard, or he saw a flash. When he went to go investigate, he saw that was, or that was the next day, that the sheep would not cross over this stream where all of this debris had fallen, right?
Correct. And we have witnesses all along the line, from hearing the muffled explosion, as Mac Brazel told his family the night that he heard it explode, to we have witnesses all along the line, witnesses at the debris field, the crash site, on the Roswell base, in the Roswell hospital, on the flights to Wright Field and Fort Worth Army Airfield. We have witnesses all along, so we know pretty much what happened in this event. And as you say, it was the rancher, he was a sheep rancher. He was the foreman of the J.B. Foster Ranch in 1947. He heard the explosion, and the next day he went out to check the sheep. And in doing that, he came upon this large field of strange metal, spread about maybe 3 football fields in length and breadth, full of this strange metal. And he went into Roswell a few days later to report it. Mostly he was interested in getting it cleaned up because his sheep wouldn't cross to go to the water, the watering place. And that's how the story got into the domain of the Air Force and also the domain of the public, because many civilians saw the crash sites, saw the bodies, were detained, were threatened with their lives, and that is one thing our investigation has uncovered, is the extent to which the Air Force went to silence civilians. Now,
in fact, I was going to ask you this question. Why do you feel that it's okay to talk about this now in such depth, revealing names and people who, children of people who took their story with them to their deathbed because of the fear and the menace of being whatever would have happened to them? Why do you feel that you can talk about it now?
Well, why not? Many of them couldn't talk years ago because they felt that they were constrained by either the threats to their family's welfare or especially the military felt that they were under some sort of security oath. Now, with the passage of time, many of the principals or the participants have passed away, and their children feel no such threat anymore to their families.
And yet, disclosure is still not on the table.
I'm sorry?
I'm saying, and yet disclosure of the UFO phenomenon is still not on the table.
No, certainly not in America, but other countries, I believe, have put it on the table. In America, they are not going to put it on the table because it would be admitting to a lie. We know the government lies, but this would be a bold-faced lie that they've been admitting to, which has now lasted 62 years. At least 62 years, and they are not prepared to do that because there'd be too many people with a price to pay, you know, including people who were not involved in it, but certainly are involved in keeping the story quiet. So there would be a price to pay for politicians especially, and politicians are not willing to pay prices. I don't look to them for strength of character.
That's an understatement if I ever heard one.
So,
okay, well, one of the points that I've discovered in the book, which I think is one of the points is very important, and that I did not know before I read your book, is that the base of the squadron that dropped the bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima was at Roswell. That really surprised me.
Yes, the 509th bomb group, it's the same group that dropped the two bombs, the atomic bombs, one on Hiroshima, one on Nagasaki, to end World War II. The 509th was created, Patricia, strictly to drop the atomic bomb. That's why it was created in 1943 and trained to drop the atomic bomb. After the war, it became our country's first SAC, or Strategic Air Command, base. And the Strategic Air Command was created to, again, deliver the atomic bomb in time of war. So they relocated from Tinian Island in the Pacific after the war to Roswell. The group was our elite military group in 1947. The most skilled officers and men charged with the most important mission. So to believe that they would mistake a rubber weather balloon and a tinfoil radar target held together by balsa wood and string for an extraterrestrial spaceship is just ludicrous. But that's what
it really pushes one's imagination, to say the very least. It's also a very interesting coincidence, let's say, because we have heard so many reports of craft hovering around nuclear facilities and military bases. And I find it particularly interesting that a craft of extraterrestrial origin would be hovering around Roswell, knowing that fact.
Well, New Mexico in 1947 was the hub of our country's atomic activity. They had Los Alamos up above Albuquerque, where the atomic bomb was basically created. All those scientists up there, they had the site, Trinity Site, down near Alamogordo, where the first atomic bomb was detonated in 1945. They had Sandia Atomic Weapons Base with were developing atomic weapons. That's outside of Albuquerque. There was the White Sands Rocket Range where the captured German V-2s were tested. So a lot was going on in New Mexico that we don't like to speculate We tried to keep speculation to a minimum, but if I was coming in from the Andromeda Galaxy, flying in, wanting to check out planet Earth, one of the places I would go immediately was to New Mexico, because that's where all of this action was taking place. And Roswell, being the home to the 509th Bomb Group, they did regular test atomic bomb runs, and they were the ones that dropped those two bombs in World War II. Also, I should mention, in 1946, there was a combined Army-Navy operation in the Pacific called Operation Crossroads. And what it was to test the effect of an atomic explosion on surface ships. So what they did is on the little atoll of Bikini, way out in the Marshall Islands, they gathered all of the surface ships, surplus ships from World War II, including Japanese ships and German ships, plus ships that the Americans didn't want. And they dropped two, actually they dropped one atomic bomb, and then the second bomb was self-detonated beneath the surface. The first one actually missed the target. One of the fins fell off after it was dropped, and it missed the target. So the second one was not dropped, but detonated subsurface and obliterated the atoll. And those photographs, you can still see them on the History Channel today. You know, they'll show one of those bombs going off, and you see the big wave of water just subsuming the surface ships. And that was Operation Crossroads.
It so amazes me that so many people forget that America is the only country that has ever used the atom bomb as a weapon.
Well, that's true. Certainly the other countries have used it in test situations, but as a weapon...
Right, we've actually dropped this bomb on another nation.
Right. Japan to end World War II, and the debate still goes on as to whether it should have been dropped or not.
Can't find a good reason for dropping an atom bomb, quite honestly. But anyway, let's not get political.
Different,
let's get back to...
Different times.
I think that a lot of people are confused, I was, as to the finding of the bodies on this craft. So you point out very clearly that there were actually two sites. You referred to this in the beginning of the book as the other site, very
yes.
Seriously. So I thought before I read your book that basically the craft skidded across this field and then somehow they found this craft at the end of a long trajectory of debris. And in fact, in the book, you discuss that it was found by the farmer, by the rancher, at another destination. Can you tell us about
yes.
that?
Yes. I had my daughter, who's a graphic artist, construct the map of New Mexico showing the three sites, because, as you say, it is confusing. The reason we understand is because we've been on the case, me for 18 years and Don Schmidt for 22 years. So it's clear to us, but to others it is confusing and it's understandable. You have three sites all in a line. You have the first site where the ship actually exploded. We believe it was struck by a strike of lightning on the evening of July the 3rd, 1947, and that's the muffled explosion that Mac Brazel and a number of his neighbors heard that evening. And all the stuff rained down, and that's when he found that large field of strange metal. That's what we call the debris field site. Strictly wreckage. Uh-huh. Strictly wreckage. Physical wreckage.
Uh-huh.
2.5 miles east of that debris field, east, southeast, Mac Brazel found something else. Now, we know that from a conversation he had with radio announcer Frank Joyce the day he went into Roswell. We also know it from the little boy that he was with the day he found the wreckage. The boy's name was D. Proctor, the son of his closest neighbors. Floyd and Loretta Proctor was with him when he found the wreckage. And it was there that years later, Dee took his sick mother, Loretta. This is 1994 now. He thought she was going to die of a, she had a blood clot in her neck, and he thought he was going to die. So he packs her up in a station wagon, and out they go into the desert. Now here she is on her deathbed, he thinks, and he takes her out in this bumpy ride out into the desert to show her this other location. And he said, here's where Mac found something else. Now, putting two and two together, Mac Brazel tells Frank Joyce he found little bodies someplace else, and Dee Proctor telling his mother, here's where Mac found something else. Plus, we have other witnesses who talked about actually seeing those little bodies on this small bluff 2.5 miles east-southeast of the debris field. We call that today the Dee Proctor body site. And what it was, we believe, was when the ship exploded, out flew three bodies. They were in the ship, unsecured, and when the thing exploded and disintegrated, out came these bodies, and they landed at this site. Now, that's the second of three sites. The third site, because we had testimony from civilians and military alike of actually seeing an intact craft. Well, what they saw was the egg-shaped inner cabin or an escape pod that was able to withstand the explosion, the initial explosion. And that stayed aloft or skidded on the ground at the debris field site and became airborne again and landed another 25 to 30 miles east-southeast of the debris field beyond the...
That's amazing.
The body site. There were bodies at that site as well. We believe there were three dead and one still alive based on witness testimony. So those are the three sites.
So there were actually seven total bodies?
We believe there were between four at a minimum and seven at a maximum. So we think there were
between
four.
That's another piece of information that's confusing because most of the stories talk about three dead and one supposedly still alive.
At the impact site. The third site is what we call the impact site. That's where the remainder of the ship that was still intact came to Earth. And we call that the impact site. We believe there were four there, three dead and one alive. We believe that at the Dee Proctor site, which I just told you about, we believe there were between two and three all dead. So that comes
because, in fact, this was something that it wasn't clear to me when in the book, and I'm getting ahead of you here, so we'll go back. But when you talk about the hospital, when they call the mortuary and they ask for caskets for small children,
yes.
I was like, this is so weird. Why would they be so revealing to ask for caskets for children when they're trying to cover this up? And why would they need so many? Because the book implied that They needed a number of these caskets.
Yes. Well, they
that was accurate because you were talking about more bodies than I thought were there. So let's go back to that point. Okay. So they find the how do you know about this the craft, the inner craft, and the three bodies, and the one alive? What is the story? Without having to go through who are the witnesses, how does the story report this last bit being found 25 miles away?
Well, talking to witnesses is how we piece it together. It's each witness, Patricia, does not know the whole story. Each witness just knows a little snippet.
Their piece.
Little piece. And for us, it's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. We put it together into a framework that makes the most sense. And
we
have witnesses to the impact site, which is now just about 40 miles north of Roswell. This is where the final, we believe it was an inner cabin because it withstood the blast. And it was, by witness testimony, it was egg-shaped. Okay? And witnesses...
So how did this get into the hands of the military?
Well, it it was discovered by civilians, and they reported it to the sheriff's office in Roswell. And every call like that that goes into the sheriff's office automatically goes into the fire department as well. So it was the sheriff's office that called the military because it sounded like they thought it was an airplane crash. So anything in the air, they're going to notify the base because, you know, it's an air base. So the sheriff notified the air base, and later on, according to his family, he said it was the biggest mistake he ever made. If he had it to do over again, he wouldn't have called the Air Force. But that's what he did. He called the base, and also he had the rancher came in to the sheriff's office. The sheriff interviewed him, and when he called the base, he said, "I have someone here who says he has found parts of a flying saucer." So that brought Jesse Marcel from the base over to the sheriff's office. Okay? Marcel sees the two boxes of wreckage that Brazel brought in, handles it, and he knows immediately this stuff is not anything that we have. So he takes it back to the base, Colonel Blanchard, who then dispatches Marcel and a counterintelligence officer, Sheridan Cavett, to follow Brazel back to the ranch to see what's out there. And that's how the military gets involved. Now, that's the debris field site. Brazel is out there with Marcel and Cavett. They don't know anything about this impact site that's north of town. They don't know anything about that. Okay. So what happens is that there's a group of archaeologists. They're out there doing their stuff, and they come upon this crashed vehicle, the escape pod or inner cabin, as we believe it was. So they report it to the sheriff's office and the fire department. And so, again, Wilcox, the sheriff, reports this to the base. Wilcox, in the meantime, he goes out there. The fire department goes out there, and while they're out there looking at this, here come the military. So that's so that was discovered separately. Before,
so while they're looking at this, they're seeing bodies?
Excuse me?
While the sheriff and the eyewitnesses, civilians, are looking at this pod that you call the inner craft,
yes,
they're also seeing the bodies in this craft.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely, and that's why.
That would be a tense moment if you were in that situation when the military walked up. I would imagine
they were threatened with their lives. They were threatened with their lives to remain silent. And
okay, so the military then go after the farmer and they take him to the base. And what happens?
Well, they keep him for a week at the so-called guest house. Brazel didn't feel very much like a guest, but they kept them there. And basically they were trying to get him to change his story, which he did, under the threat of intimidation and the threat of reprisal to his family, and perhaps with the aid of a bribe. There were reports that Brazel was able to buy a brand new pickup shortly after that. So they get Brazel, who had already reported the story to Frank Joyce, who was an announcer at the local radio station. He told Joyce that it was he found the spaceship, the little fellas out there, and blah, 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 blah. Well, they get Brazel to change his story finally. So they march him around to the two radio stations in town and to the two newspapers in town to tell a news story that he made a mistake, that it wasn't a spaceship, it was a weather balloon. So after he does that, they take him back, hold him for a little longer, and then after a week, they return him to his ranch. So
a few days after, he has a new car and drives off into the sunset, is that right?
Exactly. He shortly thereafter, he quit working at the ranch, went back to his home in Tularosa, New Mexico, and opened up a business. Now, here's a guy who never had two nickels to rub together, going back home. He's not a foreman anymore. He's had it with being a foreman and being threatened, and he opens up his own business. in Tularosa. So something went on there, and he benefited financially, but it took years for him to sort of, in dribs and drabs, tell his family members what happened. And they all report that he was very bitter because he felt he was just doing his civic duty by reporting this. And he said that in the newspaper article that came out the next day, this would be July 9, where he said it was a weather balloon that he had made a mistake. But at the end of the article, he says, "Oh, by the way, I'm familiar with weather balloons, and it wasn't a weather balloon. And if anybody thinks I'm ever going to report anything to the military anymore, they're nuts. It'll have to be an atomic bomb before I say anything." So,
even have to read between the lines on that one.
Right. He's basically taking away the story he just told.
Right,
he just told the weather balloon story, and then he says, "Don't believe it."
Yeah.
So, he died in 1963, long before any of us ever heard about Roswell.
And you know what's so frustrating about this story, and certainly I'm sure it is for you, is that you gotta believe that a piece of this debris is somewhere hidden.
Yeah.
With all of these witnesses and all of these, this 2 miles, was it, of debris? Surely somebody's got a piece of this somewhere.
Yes.
But of course our government has started to develop a memory metal, which is how this debris was identified.
It's interesting. Of the civilians, the least cooperative have been the Corona ranchers. Witness testimony, the fear of God was put into them by the military, because they went out there looking for these pieces you just mentioned, because in normal plane crashes, I say normal, but in plane crashes, it was always the civilians who got to the sites first, looking
mm-hmm.
to get souvenirs and see what's what. And in this case, the civilians got to both sites first. And we've talked to a number of witnesses who saw the wreckage, handled the wreckage. And we know that some of them at one time had pieces, but they all denied still having them. The military came out, ransacked their ranches, looking for pieces of metallic objects. They ransacked the ranches, lifted up the wooden floorboards, cut out the meal sacks that they used to feed the cattle, drained water cisterns, thinking that they might have put some in the bottom of these water tanks. They just did everything to these people. And understandably, when people came calling decades later, they did not want to talk. And we still believe.
Don't you just feel that there's a little piece or 20 buried somewhere under the soil?
Certainly under the soil. So we certainly believe that the military didn't get it all. We also believe that there still are pieces in the possession of civilians. And we know that for sure. But we have not been able to secure a piece. We're still hoping.
How do you know that for sure?
Because people that we trust have told us so, that they know somebody who has a piece, and they're just waiting for someone to pass away before they give it up, and the person hasn't passed away yet. But
on the other hand, let's say that the military had access to all of this metal and have been able to reproduce it, because we are starting to hear about memory metal now.
Yes.
What do you think of that possibility? So that in the event that it comes out, it may not even look like foreign substance.
Well, the memory metal is our holy grail. Don Schmidt and I are looking for a piece of memory metal. Now, this was the piece of metal that is like light as a feather, thin as the tin foil, like in a cigarette.
Yep.
Pack of cigarettes. I don't smoke, so I'm reaching for the words.
Gum wrapper on spearmint gum.
Yes, and it's been reported by those who handled it that it was, you couldn't cut it, You couldn't burn it. You couldn't scratch it. You couldn't deform it in any way. But yet, you could wad it up in your hand to where it felt like you had nothing in your hand, hold it over a flat surface, say about a foot, let it go, and before it hit the surface, it would flatten right out to a flat piece without a crease. So that's our holy grail, the memory metal. Now, what you alluded to is something that we have just learned within the last 6 months. We have an associate in Florida by the name of Anthony Bergaglia who has been investigating the Roswell case on his own. And he started investigating what might have happened to the wreckage that was taken to Wright Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, which is the home of the Foreign Technology Division, which sort of tries to re-engineer everything. Like if you capture a latest MiG-29 aircraft, they will try to re-back-engineer it. Well, mm-hmm. In this case, they had all this wreckage, and Tony was able to locate scientific papers after 1948 that dealt with a contract that the Air Force had given to Battelle Memorial Institute in Dayton, Ohio, in Columbus, Ohio, to try to re-engineer this memory metal. Now, the Air Force was able to determine in their own labs that the memory metal was made up of a combination of titanium and nickel. Those were the two major elements, but they were both pure grades of nickel and titanium, which we didn't have at that time. So they farmed it out to Battelle, who runs a number of laboratories in the country, and they came up with this nickel titanium alloy that they call nitinol, which in effect is memory metal. Now, it's not as good as the memory metal that's been reported on these crafts, so we're still working on it, but yet it's the same idea. And Tony was able to trace all of these scientific articles back to right after the Roswell crash. There was nothing prior to the Roswell crash in 1947 regarding experiments on nickel and titanium or on what they called morphing metal or shape recovery metal. Nothing. It's only after the Roswell crash under these Air Force contracts. So you put two and two together, it's pretty compelling.
It is compelling. You know, I had Stephen Bassett. Do you know him?
Yes.
From the Disclosure Project. All right. So we were talking about this, the fact that we need to, at the very least, embrace the idea of ET presence so we can start getting some of this technology, and hopefully we've got technology that can really benefit humankind and the planet.
Well, nitinol,
this is just an example of it. I mean, you know, I think that surely a lot of the spin-offs of our technology are, like you said, back-engineered from things that they've gotten their hands on.
Well, we're already using nitinol in medical devices. It's now being tested for the space program because it has this morphing quality. Suppose you have a spaceship launch where you want to have a telescope or a cast, put something into space and it's hit by a meteorite. You don't want your metallic, the skin of your device being all dented, but it will recover its shape. You know what I mean? So,
gotcha.
So when you return to the atmosphere, you don't burn up because you want to have a smooth surface. So it's being tested for the space program. Something as mundane as the, on your eyeglasses, what do you call those things that go over your ears?
The ear frames.
The frames that go over your ears.
The frames, yeah.
If you notice, many of them today, you can just twist all over the place and they come back to the original shape. Those are mostly titanium. Mostly titanium, which the genesis came from the Roswell crash. Okay, shape recovery.
This is such an important element in the whole UFO ET presence concept, because just getting off the scientific track here for a minute, and let's get really way out there, you know, we can talk about, are we getting our technology from our own future selves? Are we getting all this weird technology from ETs or whatever? There are so many hypotheses that are all fun to contemplate, but here we have fact. I mean, this memory metal is so important to the story, and like you said, you've got nothing about it before Roswell, and then bingo, you've got all of these people talking about seeing this metal, and bingo, suddenly we start to see laboratories working with these properties.
And here's something interesting for your listeners, Patricia. It's not in the book, but we've learned of it since the book. I got an email right after the book came out from a fellow who was in one of the Battelle laboratories working on this stuff. He said they brought this stuff in. They said it was from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. He said it looked like a bunch of junk. They dumped it on the table, said, figure out what this is. That's all they told him. Figure out what this is. And he started describing for me the memory metal, how he could wad it up and it would do all these recovery things. And so the job was to figure out what it was made out of, what it was, and try to re-engineer it. And we have a live person who worked on that since the book
came
out.
That's very exciting. When did you get that little piece of information?
About 2 weeks after our book came out. Got an email. Because we give our email.
That's amazing, Tom.
Yes. So we're going off in this direction with high hopes. He actually also sent me he says he kept a piece of this original wreckage that was brought in, and he sent me a photo, and I believe it's a photo of the original Roswell wreckage.
Oh, and my God!
Yes.
Thank you for giving this gift to my audience. This is kind of breaking news. Are you going to be able to go look at this piece?
I have the photo, and we have yet to decide what the venue will be to release it. I believe I'm going to, well, I don't believe, I know, I'm going to show it in my presentation next week at Rosdown in Roswell.
Oh, I wish I could be there. You know, I'm over here in Italy, so I'll be there with you in spirit, but boy, that's going to be an exciting moment.
This is the first genuine piece of wreckage that I've ever seen. Okay,
is he going to invite you to actually touch this? Come and see it in person?
We haven't gotten that far yet. I'm happy he sent me the photo. And,
I would imagine so. In fact, let's not jump the gun here.
Yes.
That is amazing.
But he kept it all these years, and I said, why did you keep it all these years? He says, it was just something extraordinary, and he kept it all these years. So it's a start. We thought, to be honest with you, Don and I thought, because we had a lead in this direction, we thought we would have a number of pieces of the memory metal in our possession already. But what often happens, Patricia, is that you get people, they say they have something, you know, it's either a photograph or a piece of physical evidence. And so far, one of two things has always happened to us. They either get cold feet or it was bogus to begin with. And in both cases, they just disappear on you. And this is
well,
what
how
happened.
Do you know that this is not bogus? I mean, what is it about the picture that strikes you? Unusual about it?
Oh, well, number one, his description of the work that he did tracks exactly with what Tony Bergaglia was telling me that they did. And he used scientific terms and processes that, way over my head. And, but his, what he was describing tracked exactly or pretty near with what Tony Bregaglia was telling me. And he, you know, the lab that he worked in is a real lab, and you know, so far I have no reason to disbelieve him.
This is kind of breathtaking for me. I certainly didn't expect to have you say that today on this program.
Well,
so I will be definitely eager to hear the audience reaction.
I have one more for you. Another
That's what we're here for.
This also has happened since the book came out. And I'm getting chills just telling you.
Me too. I'm just waiting.
We have found the driver of the Air Force ambulance that drove the bodies, the dead bodies, from the impact site north of town. Now, remember now, this is the third site.
Yes, well, you wrote about him in the book.
Yes, we have, since the book has come out, we have been in touch with the family of the driver of the ambulance that drove those bodies from the site, the crash site, back to the base hospital. And it's just an incredible story. The fellow, just to make sure, he is in the yearbook. We have a yearbook from 1947, the only year they published a yearbook on the Roswell base of the airmen and women who were on that base. This fellow is in the yearbook, so we know we got the right guy. And according to his family, he's passed away, but he told them the whole story. He told them the whole story. We've been in touch with him, and it's incredible. He was the driver.
What's the story?
Well, he was the was called out to the site, and he saw three dead aliens. There was one that was alive, but he was told to put the dead ones in body bags, and he described them. And they drove them back to the base, and he described the features pretty near what everybody else who had seen them has described. 3.5 to 4 feet tall, very large head for its frail frame, very large head. No nose, just two holes in the front. Where the nose would be, two holes in the side of the head where the ears would be. No ears, but the two, what would you call it, the ear hole. And the head was large. It looked like an inverted egg sitting on top of this frail frame. And it had, four fingers. But they had not suction cups, but the tips of the fingers were like little smooth discs. And he went into a lot of different things. He knew someone. One of the fellas who was with him at the time later committed suicide. It's a story that's still developing, but it's just an incredible discovery for us, and I'm thinking hard now how we came to find this fellow.
I'll tell you what, if I had a mystery to uncover, I would certainly want you and Don on the case.
We have over 600 witnesses now that we've interviewed. We've interviewed over 1,000. Probably over 2,500 people, but of those 2,500 people, we have 600, over 600 who have attested that it was not a weather balloon, but an extraterrestrial spaceship. From whereabouts, we don't know, but it crashed, in 1947. We have over 600. The Air Force has zero. Let me repeat that. The Air Force has zero witnesses to a balloon event. Mac Brazel's pasture. None. But they're sticking to their story that it was a balloon, but we're still finding new key witnesses. They might not all be still alive, but their families are. And, we are still on this case, Patricia, until we're building the case We're solving the case one witness at a time until we get into our hands an incontrovertible piece of memory metal that we can...
Sounds like you're getting pretty close there, Tom.
We think we are.
But the thing is, of course, the government can easily say that, oh, yeah, this is... Look, we've got this.
Well, no, it's trending in that direction. We've got this memory metal, but it's certainly not as good as the original. Do you know what I mean? You can still tell the difference, but the idea is the same. And the idea came from Roswell.
The original is the original.
Yes.
All right, I'm going to ask you a philosophical question here, Tom.
Yeah.
Because I like to take it to that level, I'd like to ask you, what is your... obviously, you, excuse the analogy, you're like a dog with a bone. You're not going to let go of this until you've got it. It's your life quest, and I just love that about anyone who is so dedicated and has such a clear mission. Question. What do you feel is going to... Where is humanity headed with this? What if you really crack this and you can prove unquestionably that this was a case of extraterrestrial interaction with the Earth?
Well, you know, Patricia, ever since we became human beings several million years ago, or maybe a million or 2 years ago, and we've looked up at the sky, we've always wondered, are we alone? And cracking the Roswell case will answer that question. We believe that we are not alone and that someone has actually come here. There are many scientists, most scientists, I would say, all agree that there is other life in the universe. The numbers are just statistically, it's impossible that there is another life. But the argument comes on whether that other life, any of that other life, has actually ever visited Earth. I believe that they have, based on the Roswell case. You know, there are other indications on, you know, but my thing is the Roswell case. And I believe, knowing that, I don't think the financial institutions will collapse any more than they already have.
Maybe they should collapse so they can reinvent themselves anyway. This is
I usually
end my shows with this kind of question, which is, what do you think is going to happen? Because, let's face it, something's got to happen quick here on planet Earth. We are in turmoil. What will happen when, and boy, what I really wish it for you to be the one who announces it, when we have unequivocal proof of contact?
Is that a question?
Yes. What do you think will happen on this planet the day of either Stephen Bassett thinks it's going to be a disclosure by a government? I believe it's going to be contact en masse by different craft. What do you think will happen when whatever that is, however it is announced to the human race, have, for once and for all, without a question, proof of contact?
It's a good question. My own belief is that certainly there will be days, if not weeks, of excitement. That's a given. But I think...
Yeah! To say the least.
And certainly there could very well be a medical benefit, a technological benefit. If the proof is in the form of a live, you know, being. But suppose it's the Air Force just admitting that, yes, something crashed at Roswell, and we know that that there are visitors to our planet. If it's not beyond that, but they're just admitting it, I don't think very much is going to change beyond what you already see. There will be the excitement, of course. There will be things to be gained just by knowledge, just the knowledge of it. But as far as benefits and things like that, I don't see anything beyond what is already taking place. And I think
then why don't they do it? I mean, I thought when Clinton announced that we might have be looking at life forms in this Martian rock, that this was the beginning of disclosure.
Well, I didn't think that. I thought I know the rock you're talking about, and they certainly look like little critters to me.
Sure did to me too.
Yes, and to me it was there was life, but it's amazing.
Right. It looked like this was going to be a departure point from which they were going to start really releasing information. Nobody was flabbergasted about that rock. I mean, people were like, wow, cool. Why are they not starting to release this information?
Because to release it would be admitting to a lie that they've been perpetrating ever since the modern age of UFOs began in 1947, that they would be admitting to having lied to us, and that's a big deal that no politician, I believe, is willing to cross that river and admit that.
Well, you know, I'd like to agree with you, but let's remember that everything under the sun that they do wrong is now dismissed as Homeland Security. Anything torture, misappropriation of funds,
I think
hijacking people is all for Homeland Security. So couldn't they just announce that this was for security and for the higher interests of the population? But now that we're past this danger, here's the deal. I mean, they're going to have to do it sometime. Otherwise, I think that, you know, maybe the ETs will make their own announcement. What do you think?
You know, they're also betting on there won't be another crash. That's another thing they're betting on. There won't be another crash. Well, you know, one could crash tomorrow, and they're taking a chance on that. But I don't see the government ever admitting this unless they're dragged kicking and screaming to the truth, because
Stephen Bassett said something like, you know, we hope that the ETs aren't going to park the mothership over the White House. But
yes,
the truth is, we definitely are, something has to happen, and it feels, with all of the sightings we've got going on now, it just feels like we are absolutely at a point of some sort of reckoning on this most important issue, where we once and for all recognize we are not orphans in this incredible universe.
One thing I guarantee you will not happen, there won't be rioting in the streets like in 1938 with that War of the Worlds radio show. You won't have rioting in the streets.
Yeah.
We're sophisticated enough today with many, many motion pictures with an extraterrestrial theme, plus our own space program. So that will not happen. We are sophisticated enough, and I think everybody would welcome the news. I really do.
I really do. I also think that the polls say something like 80% of the population believe in ET anyway. I think that the government should stop being our big babysitters, and let's get on with the incredible task at hand of becoming part of the Galactic
Family. But you know what they did, Patricia, is they decided back in 1947 and reaffirmed again in 1953 to suppress this information because they felt it was... reporting UFOs was a national security risk because, they didn't want the lines of communication tied up with our military establishments with UFO reports. So they decided on this pathway to suppress information and ridicule it so they could kill the reporting of UFOs. And
keep working on war.
Well, that's what the military does. That's what they do. My own belief is that we are sophisticated enough today that if the truth were revealed, I know I wouldn't go running out into the street in a panic, and I don't think anybody else would either. I don't think religious institutions would be affected. I don't think financial institutions would be affected. Life, at some point, would get back to normal. But with the new
whatever
knowledge,
normal is.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to throw this out to the audience. We've got to wrap up the hour now. So you've got my internet, and again, it's info@SyrianRevelations.net. send in your comments about this question. What will happen when that great hour occurs? And you know, boy, wouldn't we love to see Tom find that piece of metal. This is almost like a novel. I love it. Thank you so much for honoring me and the people that are tuned in to get that little piece of exciting information.
We are...
keep me posted, okay?
I am honored to be on your show, and we are on this case until the finish. And we are...
I love it!
You are the man!
All right. Listen, again, you have been listening to, I'd say, you know, a modern day, well, I won't say hero yet, but boy... Two guys who are determined to break the story of all time. The man is Thomas Carey. The book is
Witness
to Roswell, Unmasking the Government's Biggest Cover-Up, and this is co-authored with Donald Schmidt. I'm going to have him on too, right? Tom?
Tell him
I'd like to have him on and have you back on, and I'm staying with you. You know, I'm following it all the way through.
Okay. I will let him know that you want him on the show. He's an excellent speaker. He's been on the case longer than me, even. And he knows, I believe, more about the Roswell case than any other civilian.
Well, I think you're probably running neck and neck. But anyway, yeah, please tell him I'd like him to come on, too, and that way he can keep me updated, and so my listeners can be updated, too. The site is www.roswellinvestigator.com. Before you leave us, when is the Roswell Convention?
It runs from July the 2nd through July the 5th. And Don
right,
Schmidt and I will be down
there. I'm jealous. I admit it. If you can make it and I can't, so... Try to get out there and see what's going on, and I guess you'll be there, huh, Tom? Yeah,
yes.
You're speaking. Meet Tom in person and get a shot of that picture. That is groundbreaking information. All right, thanks, Tom. I've got to tune out now for the moment, but it has been amazing talking to you. Please stay in touch with me. Be my friend.
Thank you very much, Patricia. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks, Tom. Okay, everybody, that's it for today. I've got goosebumps. I just love it. This is... In Italian, they say roba per i miei denti. It means something I can chew on. The story of Roswell, major exciting. Don't forget to check my website, www.SyrianRevelations.net. Check my blog. I try to keep you up to date on things that I really think matter on this planet. Again, please help the whales. Without them, we don't have any ocean. Without any ocean, we won't be around to make contact with ETs. All right, you guys, thank you for tuning in. Remember that my show is now airing on Saturday at 10 a.m., so anybody that missed this interview can catch Tom on Saturday at 10. Please spread the word and know that I'm moving to Saturday at 10 at the beginning of August. All righty, that's for you guys who have told me it's hard to listen in on Thursday. Thank you. Thanks, Tom. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
Ciao.